Hi, I'm Gregory Orr, grandson of Jack L. Warner and producer of the documentary Jack L. Warner, The Last Mogul. And you are listening to The Extras.
Hello and welcome to The Extras. I'm Tim Millard, your host. And joining me today to talk about the Looney Tunes Collector's Choice Volume 3, which just recently came out on Blu-ray, are animation historians Jerry Beck and George Feltenstein of the Warner Archive. Well, hi, George, Jerry. It's great to have you on the podcast to talk some more Looney Tunes.
Great to be here.
I echo Jerry's sentiments 100%.
Well, it appears you have another hit on your hands with Looney Tunes Collector's Choice Volume 3. I mean, 1 and 2 has sold terrific. And from what I can see, it appears Volume 3 is selling well and is a real hit with reviewers. How did you go about selecting another 25 of these cartoons from the vaults? And I watched them, and they're all so fantastic.
Well, I'm glad you think so. They are. I'm glad you think so. I think that all of the Warner Brothers cartoons created during that golden era are great. There are obviously some that are better than others and some that are masterpieces of cinema, in my opinion. We've been doing this for a long time, George and I.
That's right.
And like at least... I mean, I don't even know, George, you would know how many years exactly we've been doing just the, you know, discs part of this.
I mean, if you go back to the laser discs, it was, I think I was about 6 years old at the time. And it was about 34 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, well, in more current era of DVD, which I think started in 2003 for the Looney.
2003.
Yeah.
And after 7 years of infighting here at the company,
right,
whether it should be for moms and kids or collectors.
Right. But all that said, we've had a great opportunity to restore the films, put out as many as we could using, you know, our noggins and our history and our love of these films and characters to determine what cartoons we would put out. You know, George... Prior to the DVD era, he mentioned the laser discs. We put out all the cartoons that we could that Turner would allow, so to speak. You know, back in those days. I mean, that was like every oddball, Merry Melody, and all that stuff. The this newer era with DVD and then Blu-ray. We've had to cherry pick a little bit because of you know how much we can do each time around and how much space there is on these discs and the costs of restoration and all that kind of thing. And despite the hundreds that we've put out, there are still a few that somehow we missed or somehow we couldn't get to or one reason or another. And that's really the background of the Collector's Choice series that we're doing right now to really get out all those others. And surprise, surprise, as you found, Tim, the ones that we didn't even get to are great.
Yeah,
so many good ones.
You know, there's no need for us to go through all 25 of these necessarily. So we'll just highlight some of them. But one of the ones that I think is a great example of what you just said is this, the first color Merry Melody short, Honeymoon Hotel. I mean, it's hard to believe that that hasn't been out before. And when I watched it, for how old it is, it looks amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty surprising. Of course, that was the first Warner Brothers color cartoon. And, you know, viewers will notice that it's primarily red shades and blue shades, I think. Or it might be green shades, I think. One or the other. Yeah. And that was the two color. George can talk more about that, but it's the two color process that was available to the studios at that time. And obviously they did what they could with the limited colors, but they did a fantastic job. It's a quintessential 1930s looking cartoon, you know, with bugs and that 1930s look. George, do you want to say something about Technicolor or
I think that this is really important. One of the things that's great about Honeymoon Hotel is that it represents exactly why Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies were created. They were created specifically to promote music that the Warner Brothers music publishing companies, which at that time were Remick, Harms, and Whitmark. They were these three huge publishing companies that Warner Brothers bought when sound came in. And then when they would write music for new films, they would be published by one of those entities. And all Warner Brothers was promoting its songs to make them more popular. That's why Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies were created. That's why there are cartoons called Plenty of Money and You and We're in the Money and Sitting on a Backyard Fence. And of course, Honeymoon Hotel. And then Jerry and my, I would say penultimate favorite, possibly, I Love to Singa. That was what their initial purpose was. And it wasn't until 1935 when we first saw Porky Pig, then we later saw Daffy Duck, then we later saw Egghead evolve into Elmer and Bugs Bunny and evolve into really Bugs Bunny. That's when they started to build the foundation of stars. Also, and just to deal with the color issue, when the Technicolor Corporation developed three strip Technicolor with red, green, and blue, Walt Disney had a 3-year exclusivity on the use of that process, which began with 1932's Flowers and Trees. So as soon as the exclusivity period was over, then Warner Brothers' Merry Melodies were all in three-color Technicolor, while the Looney Tunes were specifically in black and white until, I think, mid-1942 or 3.
I think,
and there became no differentiation between the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. But back to these shorts, which are really quite wonderful. Jerry and I always have a great deal of fun trying to pick out what we think will be a diverse program. And it's also frustrating because we wish we could be releasing 250 at a time instead of 25. But costs are high, and by releasing as much as we have in less than a year, 70 cartoons, that's a lot. And we're very, very grateful because the strata here was films that had not been released on DVD or Blu-ray before and presenting them in high definition. Now, we've been questioned or taken to task a little bit about certain cartoons which were used as bonus material, unrestored, unremastered, and thrown on some of the Golden Collection DVDs. We did consider them to have been released because that wasn't part of our programming and creating those Golden Collections. Someone else decided to do that, which created a great deal of confusion. There's one other cartoon which was remastered on a DVD but looked awful, and that is Riff Raffy Daffy. And I think it's important to talk about that here because we came to the conclusion in wanting to make it look great, we discovered that the original negative has been lost for close to 60 years. And that was shocking to me. We were able to trace it back and see that people were making backup elements in the mid-1960s, but there's no trace of the original negative. So we used a nitrate studio print, which was not ideal and didn't rise to our level of perfection, but it looks better than it ever has before. So we decided that it was worth moving forward because when we were starting to work and we found out there was no original negative, we considered pulling the cartoon and we decided to use every tool at our disposal to make it look the best that it could be. So people tend to agree that it looks better than it ever has, but there's this heartache for those of us that love these films that we can't find something better. I'm hoping that it's in the wrong can. It's marked as, you know, real seven of The Man I Love with Ida Lupino or something, you know, it's just in the wrong can someplace.
Yeah. And people should know out there that that sort of thing has happened.
Oh, boy, it sure has.
Yeah. So it's not a crazy thought that, hey, maybe it's mislabeled. That's happened. And the good news is that's how films are eventually found, you know, is that we find them eventually. But.
Well, there was another one, George, that I wanted to ask you about that was kind of like Honeymoon Hotel, and that was the one from 1935. Mr. and Mrs. is the name.
Right.
Is that kind of the one of the other, second oldest that's part of this collection? It has a very similar look and feel, too.
And well, then, yeah, that's another early color, maybe it's even two color cartoon. One of the big differences, that one is also from the, I believe, the original Cameron egg.
Exactly.
Looks particularly sharp. Interesting notes about that one is that the little boy, in particular, Little Mermaid Boy, pretty much the same model of their current at that time star character, which was a character named Buddy, a little boy character. And it's pretty much all of the fans, and I'd agree, pretty much it's Buddy as a mermaid underwater. You know, it's a weird thing to say. It's almost as if, you know, if they had done that with Porky Pig or something, but it does. I don't know why they did that exactly, but it looks great. It's got a lot of funny things in it. There's caricatures of Harpo Marx. It's a great, you know, again, another perfect period piece from that era. And in a way, I'd like it almost to be a signal that. You know, we haven't forgotten these cartoons. We haven't put out as much of these 30s musicals as I'd like, and as I think a lot of fans would like. And we haven't forgotten them, and we hope to get a chance to put out more.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4/6 Success Filmmaking. 4/6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4/6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the nice things about the way you're doing these is that each one of the volumes have had shorts from various decades. So as you're watching it, like I watched it back to back to back, it becomes this kind of wonderful evening of diversity. So you're not just only watching, you know, ones from the 30s.
Well, you know, it's funny when I was putting together the package and we looked at it from afar for a second, I didn't realize till then that the dates on the cartoons ranged perfectly from the early from 1934, not the beginning of Looney Tunes, but the beginning of color. And the latest short on there is from 1964, exactly 30 years. And it really does span that period. You really can get a good feel of where they went, where they come. I mean, you've got everything in here from those early musicals to the wackiness in the 40s and 50s. And some really unique shorts from the 1960s that I'm personally getting a lot of good feedback for putting those on, George. I not that we wouldn't have, but we hadn't before. You know, there's a lot of people who are like, I don't like the 60s. There's some great stuff there. And we have some great ones on here.
Well, and the other thing is, and this is very important, just because we, Jerry and I, may like a cartoon or not like a cartoon. There are some of the, I really should be calling them films, because I think that's really even more important. Sometimes people take the term cartoon as diminishing, because these are short American films of great historic significance and great entertainment. But I think one of the things is, just because Jerry or I may prefer a cartoon or not like another cartoon, what we're out to do here is give a diverse representation from the early decades to the later decades And there are some people that prefer, and I think it reflects when they grew up and how they saw them. Some people prefer the cartoons from the late 60s. Jerry and I may have other opinions of those cartoons, but the idea is to get all of them in the best possible shape and out there for people to enjoy.
Yeah.
We're trying to have a balance.
Yeah. And I love the idea that there are people who may prefer those later ones and are now being exposed to some of the earlier ones that they probably never would have watched or had no access to. A lot of people I know, younger people, who grew up watching Bugs Bunny, Roadrunner Hour, you know, one of their favorite cartoons, because it was run so often on that show, was Wet Hair, one of the last Bugs Bunny cartoons ever. It's on this set with the it's Bugs Bunny and versus a logger who's cutting off water for Bugs to take a shower. Anyway, it's a strange late cartoon run many, many times, and is a nostalgic memory. And it's that way because it really hasn't been seen that often since the Bugs Bunny show went off the air, and we never put it on video. So I'm getting cheers for that particular film. And the people who love that film have never seen things like Honeymoon Hotel and Mr. and Mrs. The Name. And so it's exposing people to the whole range of Looney Tunes and creating new fans because of that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the marvels of these three volumes is that they are the ones you haven't, for many of us, that you haven't seen or been exposed to. Or if you did, it was so long ago that you've forgotten them. And, you know, the gold collection brought out the ones that were the most popular, probably the most requested. But these now are bringing out a whole different batch, which really makes them special. And I think, George, from the response we got, you know, when the listeners called in for the 15th anniversary, you know, appreciation, so many people talked about just that, about how much they're loving these volumes because of the variety.
Well, there's been a great frustration just between Jerry and myself that this whole incredible library of animated films created under the aegis of Warner Brothers has been dormant in the home entertainment market for too many years, I'll say that. The propulsion never should have stopped. I wasn't in a position to be able to do anything about that because my role was primarily in theatrical features. And then when Warner Archive came along, we were not allowed to have access to the animation. And with the growth and success of Warner Archive, it became a significant enough business within the home entertainment division that we were given a broader opportunity to explore more diversification in our content. And especially, we were finally able to open the door for Warner Brothers cartoons. And we hope to keep that door open as long as possible.
Jerry, I wanted to go back and ask you about something that obviously those who are, you know their animation history a little bit more, this might be a little bit more of an obvious question. But for those who are buying these volumes who don't know the history as much, there are early appearances of Egghead and Elmer. And yeah. I thought maybe you could explain, like, how are those two characters one and the same or different? Because I thought it was fascinating to watch these.
Yeah, it's pretty odd. It's taken years for me to figure it out and look at things. The reality is there's two separate characters. One's named Egghead and one's called Elmer Fudd. But they share a similar look in their design. But it's not. The thing is, if one looks very closely at the listens to their voices, looks at their image, they're not exactly the same. Egghead was more of a Tex Avery loony character. Elmer's sort of more of a, I want to say a dullard. You know, he's sort of a square. And that's really where the Elmer Fudd that we know comes from. It's just in the early phases, they had them both that way. And every once in a while, we've now found, because so many people are as interested in this as I am, We have found all kinds of merchandising, letterhead, where they mixed it up, where they'll have a picture of what is Egghead labeled Elmer, and they'll do vice versa. So even then there was confusion. But the reality is, in the films, the characters are different and have a little bit of a different personality and have a little bit of a different look to them. Elmer is really the guy in the early ones who has his collar, you know, up high, and Egghead doesn't. You know, if you look at a cartoon like Egghead Rides Again, or, you know, some of those early ones, Daffy Duck and Egghead, you know, he's this character with a big bulbous nose and the other. And Elmer is this other character with the little top hat and a high collar. And that's really the close, quick, you know, way to determine who's who in these early ones. But unfortunately, they themselves, almost created the confusion. You know, again, in the beginning, people really weren't paying attention. They didn't debut. Here's a little history lesson. I'll try to make it brief. But back in those days, back in the 30s and 40s, they didn't pitch a cartoon to the producer, and they came in with a pitch board and pictures and, hey, here's what he looks like. Here's what he does. He lives in this environment. They do that today. That's what they've been doing for the last 40, 50 years for television and other things. But back in those days, the cartoonist ran the studio. If they came up with some funny ideas, they created a character for it. If that character got laughs, they did another one, and they would refine that character and refine it. All of our favorite characters, especially Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, were evolved on screen. We saw them as you see, you know, as you watch them and as they came out. So that's just the way it was done then. And that's why there's this confusion. Ultimately, they established Elmer, you know, as the character we know him as he is in A Wild Hare, the first official Bugs Bunny cartoon. And he took over, and Egghead sort of faded away. But it still lingers, occasionally pops up on a show like Tiny Toons or something like that. So there's my history lesson for today on that.
Well, one of the reasons why I ask is that three on here directed by Tex Avery that I thought kind of fall right into that discussion. You've got Egghead Rides Again, 1937, that he directed. Then you've got A Feud There Was, which he directed.
Yeah.
That one's Elmer. So you get
it's Elmer because it's labeled. It's actually, you know, he's labeled Elmer Fudd in the cartoon. So we know that that's Elmer.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you've got Cinderella Meets Fella, which is also.
That's Egghead, I think.
It says Elmer in.
Does it? See, I'm confused.
It's really confusing because they say Elmer and there's like a little sign, I believe.
There's also the Elmer's Pet Rabbit is on here, too, where he's an established Elmer at that point.
But you know, not established Bugs Bunny.
No. Yeah.
I mean, it's confusing. I'm going to go back and look at Cinderella now.
Well, those I mentioned the first three because they were all directed by Tex Avery, and he directed both characters. And I thought all three of those were really great. I mean,
makes sense.
A Feud There was a great way to start off this this volume. I thought it's hilarious. So well done, Tex Avery, of course, beloved. But I don't know, it just led me to think, okay, how are these characters a little bit different? What's the difference there? So.
Well, just for the record, it's a random mix, literally, and I think like the volume two, they're in alphabetical order, which I think is fantastic, you know, because it really gives you a 30s next to a 50s, next to a 40s, next to a 60s.
Okay. And
it's just the way we used to watch them on Channel 5, you know.
Hey, can we talk about Cinderella Meets Fella for a second? Okay. I mean, the ending?
Okay, he says, pulling out his handy-dandy reference.
Specifically, what about the ending was exciting?
What about the ending is it that you wish to...
Well, I mean, she goes from being on screen, right? She's Cinderella.
Oh, yes.
Then she's watching... I mean, it's so meta, right? Because now all of a sudden she's watching in a theater the short, and then... and then he calls out to her. Then she comes up on stage. I mean, it's fantastic.
Right. That's actually, I love that. I mean, that is what Tex Avery was all about. He was the person in the theater, like the rest of the audience, the cartoons come on, the shorts come on, the travelogues, and it's almost like he's having a Mystery Science Theater conversation with the screen on his head. And he put that in the films. The characters acknowledge they're on screen, that they're in cartoons, that they could come out into the audience, that they can talk to the audience. These cartoons, I've said this before, probably on this show, were never meant to be seen again. They were designed for theaters. They were meant to be seen at that time, in that situation, and they're interactive with the audience. They're fantastic. Can you imagine this is why they became so big, the Warner cartoons. This is why they were so different from what Disney was doing and the other studios were doing. They played with your head, and that's how they got famous. You know, yeah, I love that.
I love it too. I mean, I can honestly say that every one of the cartoons in this collection and in the two collections prior, I love them. You know, they vary between cute, good to unbelievable genius.
Right. Yeah.
There's just such a variety. And you really get to see the growth, the development. And we didn't plan it this way, but going alphabetically is kind of like putting your iPhone music on shuffle. You know, you just don't know what's coming next, rather than sitting through 12 cartoons with one character in a row. It's much more entertaining this way. And yet people have also the opportunity to select whatever they want to watch. And the whole format seems ideal for home entertainment, and that you own them with the best possible quality.
You know, that cartoon in particular, Cinderella Meets Feller, and there are many others that do that sort of movie gag. The thing is, that's what to me makes them part of film history, cinema history, Warner Brothers history, cinema going history, something we might be losing these days. I don't know. But, you know, they were part of the golden age of Hollywood, you know. To me makes them extra, you know, extra special.
Yeah. I wanted to call that one out because I mean, you have to, I mean, I think on this set, it's like such a unique one. But that's just my opinion, of course. But I think, hey, you mentioned a couple others in the kind of the announcement, George. You said there were hilarious rarities with Bobo the Elephant and Quentin Quayle. So I thought maybe we should talk about that a little bit too. Those are some early ones. And were those characters that are not as popular?
Those, well, I could let George talk if you were directing that question to George. But
either one.
You take it, Jerry.
You know, Warner Brothers has so many great characters that are famous. Every one of them a star. Even the smaller things, the supporting players, you know, whether it's Marvin Martian or, you know, the Tasmanian Devil, a villain only in 5 cartoons back in the golden age. They had this great ability to create characters. And of course, occasionally they would create cartoons that the characters didn't take off. All the directors had a wonderful opportunity there. They had to do X number of Bugs Bunnies because Bugs Bunny was the star. They had to do a few Porky Pigs, a few Daffy Ducks every year. They had a little quota system. But they also had the opportunity to do 2 or 3 just whatever you want. Well, whatever you want kind of things. I don't think it was even planned this way, but the whatever you want was valuable, because what happened was they would do a cartoon with some new situation, creating a new character for that situation. And then 9 times out of 10, that character, that cartoon, that situation would become now some kind of a standard thing. It would become a star character. That's how literally every character that we know of and love came to be, whether it's Foghorn Leghorn, Pepe Le Pew, Speedy Gonzalez, on and on and on, all came out of these little one shots. You know, we don't look at them that way. We look, oh, that's the first Pepe Le Pew cartoon. Well, the thing is, it was a one shot cartoon. People loved it. The response came back, make another one of those. And they made another one. So these two are characters that only appeared briefly. Bobo actually appears in two cartoons. Bobo's a little elephant character that Robert McKimson created and got into all kinds of little. I just thought it was a funny idea to have this little smart aleck elephant. And, you know, there wasn't any great demand for the character after making two of them, which were made like years apart. And so they're rarely shown. And that's the thing about those one-shot ones. They're rarely shown. Now, Quentin Quayle is an oddity because, again, no reason why they couldn't have continued these characters, which essentially in that one cartoon is very dated in that they're based on the Baby Snooks, Fanny Bryce radio show of the 1940s. Unless you watched Funny Girl, you don't know who Baby Snooks is.
Well, they don't even deal with Baby Snooks in Funny Girl. They do in Funny Lady, though.
Oh, is that the one? Yeah, I know she, because I remember seeing Barbara dressed in that little baby.
Yeah.
So the cartoon is just literally a parody of that very, very popular radio show. I remember it as a kid. I never understood this cartoon. Why is the character talking like that? It didn't make any sense to me whatsoever. It's Chuck Jones, which makes it great already, in my opinion. The title, and I'm not going to even begin to explain or even understand it, is a play on a controversy or a term back in the 1940s, which was kind of an adult thing, but I'm not going to get into it now because I don't know it enough to explain it. So it's a very strange cartoon, but nothing's wrong with it. No reason we can't show it or play it. And it's one of those ones we just never got around to putting out. And that's, again, quintessential. I use that term a lot, but quintessential perfect cartoon for this set, for the collector's choice, because it's the kind of thing we, you know, would have ignored. We did ignore and shouldn't ignore. And I'm so happy we have it restored and back now. Hope that answers.
I agree with you more. I mean, that's really what motivates us to try to put together, you know, an elaborate smorgasbord of animation.
You know, I'm going to bring this up, but one thing I feared on the selection we had was there was few cartoons on here that I've even been public about it. George, don't worry.
I know what you're going to say. Yeah,
that I've been public about that are like, I considered the weakest of certain cartoons, of the Bugs Bunny cartoons. They were never on any of the sets. Just honestly, personally, I felt these are weak. And let's hold them off. And on the other hand, the completest that I am as a collector has always wanted them on video so I could have them. And I got to tell you, I got two surprises out of the three of those cartoons rewatching this set. I'm going to mention their titles. One of them is Prehysterical Hair, a cartoon that's got a lot of problems. One of the problems, George will admit this, it's one of the few cartoons that wasn't scored by the Warner Brothers.
That's right.
One of those, John Seeley?
Seeley 6, we call them.
The Seeley 6 stock music. That's one problem.
That was due to a musician strike that affected all the studios. And I think it was 1958.
Yeah. So that's an issue. That was an issue already. And then in this cartoon, the storyline has Bugs Bunny going, at least they're looking at a movie that transports us back to a prehistoric days. And we see Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd as cavemen. Okay. Problem number two, the caveman known as Elmer Fuddstone in this particular cartoon, right, this is one of the first cartoons after Arthur Q. Bryan, the original Elmer Fudd voice, had passed away. So they recruited another actor, Dave Barry, who did many, many voices. By the way, George, Dave Barry, it was in Warner cartoons all along doing mainly one of his most famous things he did in the Warner cartoons is he's the imitator of Humphrey Bogart.
Right.
Slick hair, an 8-ball bunny. Yeah. Fellow American down on his luck. That was this guy, Dave Barry. And they called him in for these special things. So they had him come in to do Elmer. And Elmer just does not sound right. So you have bad music. Elmer doesn't sound right. And Bugs and Elmer are drawn as Neanderthals, which, you know, already, again, that's not Bugs Bunny and Elmer to me. So I had issues with this cartoon. Now, watching it on Blu-ray blew my mind because the background art in this cartoon is amazing. And it's a weird thing to talk about. I'm not going to go into it, but I couldn't believe my eyes because I'd only seen it on TV and 16 and all that sort of thing. And man, it's gorgeous looking. I have watched it more than once now, just looking at the backdrops. They did a really good job on that. And I'm just the fact that it changed my mind, that my consciousness has been raised. I'm happy about that in that particular cartoon. The other one was a cartoon by Chuck Jones that I actually always had considered my least favorite Chuck Jones cartoon. It's called Hair Breath Hurry. And it's a cartoon where Bugs Bunny takes the place of the Roadrunner. It's essentially a Roadrunner cartoon, yeah. But it's got Bugs Bunny in it. And I always thought that's really, okay, I give it a, Chuck was an experimenter. He did all kinds of experimental things in these cartoons. You know, I chalked it up to, why not? You know, let's go for it. New research, looking into the production numbers and things, have found a very interesting fact. And I love this, and it makes me actually at least love this cartoon. Maybe not love it, but I can now watch it in its proper context. It turns out at one time, George knows this, there was going to be, in addition to the Bugs Bunny show, there was going to be a proposed Roadrunner show. And they made a pilot of which we released, Warner Brothers released, because it didn't turn out to be a TV show that got picked up. Warner Brothers refashioned it as a featurette that was released to theaters called The Adventures of the Roadrunner, which we've put out on DVD. And what it turns out is that the production numbers match up, that this was going to be for the second episode of the Roadrunner show. This would have been the bridging material, or at least that was the proposal. That was what was on the boards. When that didn't happen, when that show was not going to be, they took the boards that they had already made and they condensed them, rejiggered them, and made it into a short, which was a great thing that they did, because they didn't waste art. They didn't waste time. They didn't waste story. They had a short ready to go. It was odd. It wasn't meant to be a short. And now it makes sense to me. It makes more sense because it's like the intermediary stuff, but in a TV show. I know it's a strange thing. I hope people can wrap their heads around that. But Hair Breath Hurry, I'm so happy you're on Blu-ray.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the other Bugs on here as well, the Elmer's Which pet one? Rabbit.
Okay.
It's get those yellow gloves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is kind of the one that he has the yellow gloves.
Pretty prominent.
I'm not sure why you're bringing it up, but it's been controversial in the fandom circles that the latest Bugs Bunny cartoons that have been made by the studio for HBO Max under the label Looney Tunes Cartoons, they redesigned them in a Tex Avery, Bob Clampett way, and they gave them yellow gloves. So a lot of fans were like, why'd they do that? And they're all upset. And people like me would come on, well, the early Bugs Bunny cartoons, he had yellow gloves. So it's, you know, don't get too excited. You know? But I mean, what's your question?
I read those too. And I was like, what is this? You know, what is this discussion about the yellow gloves? And I, you know, when I first watched it, I didn't even notice it really. I mean, it didn't really, you know. And then after I was like reading a little bit about, I was like, what's with these yellow gloves and all this conversation? And is that important? I don't know.
Is it important? No, I don't think so. But you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's just cartoons in the end. You know, this is entertainment. These are comedies. You know, things are done to make you laugh, yeah, basically, and, you know, to entertain. Well, and we got to remember that.
You know, what's, you know, Jerry, people, people take your opinion very seriously. So I was going to ask you about this supposed collection that includes Jerry's least favorite bugs, you know, cartoons, which you just mentioned, prehistoric hair and all. And it's interesting to hear your take on seeing these now in HD and how even that is changing or influencing you. Oh, yeah. And also, you know, I don't know, years later, maybe there's a different way of appreciating these too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we all grew up watching them on television. 9 times out of 10, maybe, unless you were watching it on CBS, where they were running 35 millimeter film prints that were edited sometimes. But our regular, your local stations ran 16 millimeter dupes, right, George? These were taken off of the AAP copies were actually Technicolor prints with their titles cut off and then duped down, you know, and duped in color. They look good, but they're so far removed from what these cartoons are. We're seeing them the way people saw them in theaters in the first place on day one of their release.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, what Jerry's saying, this is very important. The 16 millimeter syndication prints weren't even Technicolor.
Right.
They were Eastman color and they faded because of that. And we were used to watching pink cartoons. That was, I think, the first breakthrough of what we were doing on Laserdisc, because those masters, we would never use them now. They were done off Technicolor prints to 1-inch videotape. What we've been able to do now, coming off the negatives, where they exist in most cases, it's just mind-blowing what we're seeing. We're seeing things we've never seen before because the clarity is tremendous. And at the same time, we make sure that we're holding to a standard where you see cell dust and you see improper anomalies that were in the original photography. And we're not going to erase them or make them look like, you know, contemporary soap opera or whatever. They need to look like film and they need to really have their aesthetic so we can get as close to what people saw on the motion picture screen when first released.
And, you know, that's the what they saw on the motion picture screen on first release is what made characters like Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and Porky Pig superstars. This is what made them that way. It's still as big as they still are. That's forgotten. You know, sometimes people forget, sometimes the companies forget what made these things popular in the first place. We're able, thanks to George, that many of our greatest films, you know, from Citizen Kane to Singing in the Rain and, you know, are available for us to be seen the way they were originally seen. But the cartoons, we have been doing that on unfortunately a slower pace throughout the years. It's we're pretty close to having almost the whole thing done.
We're making headway, and the thing is, what we've been trying to do for decades now is to enlighten other people to understand that these are pieces of American cinema, classic pieces of American cinema. And just like I always say with older films, not every old film is a classic.
Right.
They made bad movies in the 30s and 40s, just like they made masterpieces. But everything needs to be preserved and needs to be saved. And prioritizing what you're going to produce, what you're going to preserve, that's constantly a battle. And as technology improves, we keep needing to make things better. So when I go back and I look at those 5 Laserdisc box sets we did, which were taken off of prints,
right?
Albeit in most cases, they were Technicolor prints, but therefore also very soft, because Technicolor prints are not ideal for transfer. There was a softness to it, but the colors were, for its time, we thought they were amazing. What we've been able to achieve subsequently, and the Golden Collection is now past 20 years old in its inception. You know, we look at that and say, my God, we've come such a long way. And these Blu-rays are an example of what can be done when you go back to the original elements and put together an entertaining program. And that's really what it's all about.
And George, I want to lead you by saying, what can people do so that we can continue doing this? Because we need to continue doing this. What can the fans do to help us?
We humbly ask that you continue to support these releases, because the more that there is consumer support for these releases, the more that we will be able to have the justification to the many channels within the organization that need to approve these things, that we will get the ability to give more. And I'm feeling very, very optimistic that things will continue to move on a forward trajectory.
Well, I asked you guys last time of a question that I want to ask you one more time here. And that was, of these 25, is there a personal favorite, not the best cartoon, not the most, you know, beloved cartoon or anything, but just when you're watching it, for one reason or another, remind you of your childhood or your youth or whatever. Is there one here that just jumped out to you? And we'll start with you, George.
Well, the one that I was just, it has always been a favorite, and I was thrilled that we could put it on here, was Mexican Joyride. People don't appreciate Arthur Davis's cartoons enough, in my opinion. He directed this, and this is almost a precursor to one of my true all-time favorite of all the Warner Brothers cartoons, and that is Bully for Bugs. It's a kind of similar story and setup, and this came first, but I love it. And Daffy is, of course, he sings. Anytime Daffy sings, I love it. But the whole cartoon is just so damn funny. Pardon my French. It's just, it's a masterpiece. And I think we've given it a showcase. It's one of the real standout cartoons among the 25, in my opinion.
Boy, oh boy. That obviously, I think I would have picked that as well. So I'm going to go in some other opposite direction, because I love all of them, and it's very difficult to pick. And if I were to go something in the opposite direction, I want to mention, it's funny, it's not a classic at all. It's the last Chuck Jones Roadrunner cartoon called War and Pieces that's on here. It's one of the latest, like 1964 release. But I love that it's on here. It's one that people have actually been asking us for years to put on here. It's not shown that much. I'm not sure why. It's so much better than some of the Roadrunner cartoons made in later years, if not by Chuck, by other people. It's just very attractive. It's kind of a swan song. I know why we've overlooked it for a long time for a lot of reasons. And I'm just kind of, it's one of those things where I, by having it on here, I know that there's a lot of fans out there who are like, thank you. And I that's what we're here to do. We're here to, you know, supply cartoons that the people who know their cartoons are looking for. I mean, that's my answer. I love all 25, so I can't.
So do I.
Like a baby. Yeah. Although I would have said, by the way, I would have said Mexican Joyride had George not, because that is a standout cartoon, and it looks jaw-droppingly great.
And I'll just add a little footnote to Mexican Joyride. By putting it on this release, we were able to get the original nitrate negative, scan it in 4K for preservation. There were no other 35 millimeter materials anywhere on this cartoon. There might have been a few years ago that went bad or whatever. So the original negative was safely kept, as was the original soundtrack. But it was our requiring this cartoon to be on this collection that led to the preservation of this cartoon. So the original negative went back into cold storage and protection, but now we have a gorgeous presentation that can be seen in all media, but you can own by having a Blu-ray on your shelf. No one can take it away from you. It won't suddenly disappear. And that's the beauty of it. So it isn't just that we made the cartoon part of the lineup. We also saved the cartoon, because until we asked about it, we didn't know that there weren't any intermediate elements. We wouldn't have used intermediate elements anyway. We always want to go for the negative. But seeing that there was nothing else, this could have befallen the same fate as Riff Raffy Daffy. You know, nitrate stock is subject to deterioration and all sorts of other terrible things. So just the fact that this cartoon is on this collection led to it also getting a proper preservation. And that needs to be celebrated.
The fans don't know how fragile these original elements are. We simply see them on TV, or they put them out on video, and where they have in the past. And it's easy to think, they've got them, or they're there. And the unfortunate truth is there's deterioration. There's all sorts of things that befall these original elements. It makes it difficult. The thing I find interesting on different discs that we've worked on, I'm thinking of a particular Popeye, the one where we only had two color elements. Remember that one? And then there's a Blitz Wolf on the Tex Avery. It's like, I remember when we saw those on Blu-ray for the first time, and we saw the scans. I was like, well, this can't be. I mean, these cartoons were on TV for years, and I've seen 16mm copies. And then what happens is you go back. To refresh my memory, I'll go back and look at another, an old Turner version of the cartoon, or a 16mm dupe I happen to have or something. And then I start to notice, what we're looking at with the scan is a cleaned up, beautiful version of what exactly I have here. The same thing that was distributed to television for decades, the same thing that somebody duped prints of for years, but I never noticed the slight imperfections that I'm now seeing on the beautiful scan. They've always been there. There isn't a better copy, or a better master. This is the way it is. We are now seeing, the best version of what exists. Does that sound right, George?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You said it more eloquently than anyone could.
It's an amazing how fast time flies when you two are on talking about these Looney Tunes films, these shorts, and how fun it is. And, again, we didn't go through all of them. There's so many other great surprises for the fans to enjoy when they get this. So thanks for coming on and talking about these with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Tim. We're grateful to have the opportunity.
Yep.
Talk about something that's near and dear to our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, it's always great to have animation historians Jerry Beck and George Feldenstein on to talk about these Looney Tunes Collector's Choice releases. And I really, really enjoyed this volume 3. I just love the variety that they have and just kind of getting these one shots and treasuries and rarities from the vault. So I hope you'll support by buying volume 3, not waiting for a sale, because that's really how the studio knows that there's an appetite for these when people are willing to spend the money right away. So there are links in the podcast show notes if you want to support the work that the Warner Archive is doing, that Jerry and George are doing, so that we can get more volumes out in this collection. And just a quick clarification, Jerry mentioned Hairbreadth Hurry, and that's actually on volume 2, but you won't find that here on the volume 3. But hopefully you have volume 2 as well, as all three volumes are a terrific addition to your Looney Tunes collection. Also, if you're enjoying the show and you are a Looney Tunes fan, you may want to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, so you can look for those links as well, so that you get all the updates on volume 3 or on any upcoming volumes. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please think about following or subscribing at your favorite podcast provider. Thank you so much. And until next time, this is Tim Millard. Stay slightly obsessed about Looney Tunes. Hi, this is Tim Millard, host of the Extras podcast. And I wanted to let you know that we have a new private Facebook group for fans of the Warner Archive and Warner Brothers catalog physical media releases. So if that interests you, you can find the link on our Facebook page or look for the link in the podcast show notes.